Defence which has been on the rise and has cost Australians up to $1 billion.
Most people sort of fantasise about flying. Most people think about it. So rather than just thinking about it, we do it.
I've been stopped on the street and spat on.
How many pages do I have to do and how much have I done so far? I've only done like 1%.
And bang, it was in like a split second. I had no time to react. I was on the ground.
Because the reason why this is even occurring is because there's a demand.
Good evening and welcome to Razor's Edge, 2SER's own Sydney-focused current affairs program. I'm Jesse Begley. From Bondi to Blacktown, Hornsby to Sutherland, our producers are out and about covering stories that no other program does. Up first, we speak with Sydney resident and CEO of the Australian Council of Social Services, Cassandra Goldie, about the effects the demerit system will have on New South Wales residents. We explored the South American medicine ayahuasca, which has been traditionally used in Amazonian religious and healing ceremonies. But with growing interest from tourists, many of them are young Australians, what exactly is ayahuasca and how common is it to Australia? We speak to former Mayor of Leichhardt, Darcy Byrne, about his proposal to cut the red tape surrounding live music and arts venues in the Inner West. And finally, we look at the spike in feral cat numbers and how Sydney animal shelters are being forced to hold the intake until next season. You're on 2SER 107.3.
On May 27, you may well have to change your plans if you don't want to miss the 2SER Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon. 2SER's celebration of all things Bob will go for 8 hours and feature news, reviews, interviews, the Bob Dylan quiz, and all the Bob songs that fit, starting at 8 p.m. and going through till 4 in the morning. The Bob Dylan Birthday Marathon on 2SER, May 27, from 8 p.m. 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music, and Bob.
With the release of the 2017 budget, the government has proposed to impose demerit system on job seekers who don't follow the strict rules. With the threat of suffering cuts or completely losing the payment, there are concerns on the negative impact it may have. Lena Han expands with this story.
A new demerit point system has been introduced to crack down on welfare recipients who fail to turn up to job interviews and appointments. As one part of major welfare sector reforms in this year's federal budget, recipients will have reduced payments at 4 points, and at 7 points they will be cut off for 8 weeks. We spoke to Cassandra Goldie, CEO of Australian Council of Social Services, about the effectiveness of this system.
We should not be designing a compliance system which is premised on cutting more people off from Social Security. We should be designing a compliance system which is looking for an outcome of more people getting into employment. But why would we be designing a system which is premised on making it even tougher for people when we know that we have one of the toughest compliance systems in the OECD? We know that it is a very difficult labour market out there. There are far more people looking for employment than the number of jobs available. There's just one job available for every 10 people in Australia who are looking for more paid work.
With extensive obligations already in place, including applying for one job a day, she believes the demerit point system will place more pressure on job seekers.
This is a really hard, a complex and quite onerous set of obligations, which in many cases are not leading to an employment outcome. So for us, we want to see changes made to the obligations associated with receiving income support so that we are really supporting people to spend their time on activities that are much more likely to be leading to an employment outcome. We understand it's tough for people and we would have liked to think the government would understand the same.
Paula, who was previously receiving the new stud allowance, now called Job Seeker Allowance, shared about the struggles to actually find a job.
So I can go to all the interviews in the world, but I wouldn't necessarily get them, and I'd still turn up, although it did used to crush me and spiral me really badly into depression. Like, I suffer depression as a lifelong condition. I've had it all my life. I grew up, I never knew any different. I couldn't get a job because no one would hire me because of my size. I was 151 kilos, but they made up all sorts of stupid excuses.
Paula also suffers from repetitive strain injury, sensitivity to light, and has hydrocephalus that causes short-term memory loss. And because of these health issues and the low payment of $110 a fortnight, she believes that it was almost impossible for her to get to job interviews.
Money-wise, on Newstart, what made it hard to find a job was how little I got. Centrelink first gave me that. I said to them, how are we supposed to live? Like, how can we do anything with that amount of assistance? That's the whole thing. I'm not good at public transport. It's like a trigger for my post-traumatic stress. I don't cope with it. But whether it was public transport or petrol, I wouldn't have been out. You couldn't do anything with it. My radiator had a problem in my car, which flooded my gearbox with water. And I had to get the whole gearbox replaced. It cost me nearly $4,000 to do a bunch of work on my car to keep me on the road to try and get a job. Anyway, it's all too hard.
While Cassandra understands the government's attempt to reduce abuse of the system, she believes these new changes will simply affect those who are already struggling.
Of course, in any big system, the tax system or the social security system, there will be a very small proportion of people who may be deliberately motivated to do the wrong thing. But Centrelink already has extensive power to deal with this. What the government has done is designed a harsher, we believe, system, because in the end the government is planning to save an estimated $200 million per year in social security payments. So what that says is that one way or another, this new demerit system will be taking more people off social security on more occasions and potentially for longer periods of time.
However, Paula believes the demerit point system also has its merits.
It kind of makes me a bit hard when it comes to that, because I think, good, maybe they should strike them if they don't turn up, because a lot of them play the system. And we were honest all the way. That was the really hard thing for me, that the more honest you are, the less help you get.
This is Lena Han for Razor's Edge.
Thank you to Cassandra Goldie and Sydney resident Paula for speaking to us for that piece. You're listening to Razor's Edge live on 107.3 and streaming online at 2ser.com. Our next story, we're talking about ayahuasca and the thousands of Australian tourists who are heading to South America to use it. Many of them, of the young Australians, flocking to the Amazon to experience ayahuasca. Traditionally, spiritual leaders known as shamans have been used to brew the mix in religious ceremonies. But as ayahuasca tourism trade booms, it has been... Can it be regulated, and what can go wrong?
The hallucination-inducing drug ayahuasca has been used for centuries by tribes in South America during spiritual ceremonies, but has become more mainstream for those seeking both an optic and auditory high. What exactly is ayahuasca, and how does it affect your body? I spoke with expert Dr. Robin Rod from James Cook University, who has spent more than a decade studying ayahuasca, and asked, what exactly is it?
It's a combination of plants that consumed as a tea, sort of decoction, a plant extraction that usually combines Banisteriopsis carpi, which is the ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is a Quechua word for vine of the soul. And then any number of other admixture plants.
Do users believe they can connect with the spirit world when they drink ayahuasca?
That's certainly the framework around indigenous use of ayahuasca in the context of spiritual religious framework referred to as shamanism, which involves communicating with spirits or entering into another dimension of consciousness or knowledge in which there are other types of information and other types of entities can become visible and in which you can engage. It really depends on what cultural background or ideas the drinker brings to ayahuasca as to whether or not they expect to experience spirits or not.
Ayahuasca retreats are being peddled as highly transformative experiences that can facilitate deep physical, mental, emotional and spiritual healing. To find out more, I spoke with 22-year-old Casey Wilson. Last year, Casey and her boyfriend travelled to the Amazon rainforest in Peru to participate in a 2-week silent ayahuasca healing retreat. What made you want to do it?
A couple of different factors made me want to do it. Curiosity was a big one. Learning and reading about it to a certain limitation. My partner at the time was more keen for it than I was, and he wanted to go, but he kind of had the courage to not do it on himself, so it all just seemed to fit. It kind of was a good place, good time, good plan, good person to go with, that all just kind of seems to be the correct thing to do at the time.
I asked her to describe how an ayahuasca ceremony works.
When you get in to a ceremony, you all have assigned seats, and it's the same seat every time. And then you go around and you make a safe space. So there's a lot of incense and sage that is burnt. There's almost like an offering or a shrine in the middle where people can bring things and offer it. And after that, you all take a turn of drinking the ayahuasca. You get like almost a little egg boiler cup full of it. And then after everyone's had a turn, they blow out all the lights and you wait about half an hour, 45 minutes in silence. And then the people who lead it, so the Peruvian maestro and two or three almost retreat leaders or retreat volunteers, will then start singing songs to guide you through kind of a musical journey. And then after that, everyone just kind of comes back into the same space, and then you can share it at the end. But as soon as you leave that Maloca, you're not allowed to speak about it again. I mean, they went strict. They said if you see your neighbours by the river, say hi or make sure that they're okay, but don't get too in-depth, because if your energies are that open and you're trying and you've had a bad experience and you tell someone, then they may think about it and take on your bad experience, and it may hurt, like hinder theirs.
Can you explain the type of people that were on your trip? Did you have something in common with these people? Could you see a common thread?
I think the common thread between everyone was we're all game enough to do something like this. Everyone came for different reasons and everyone came for different outcomes. So I think a lot of people, particularly on my retreat, were there for either spiritual or emotional reasons. There are a handful of people who were there for medical reasons, and there was one person in particular who was there who really just kind of wanted to experience the high, and he was immensely disappointed not even halfway through, so he ended up leaving early. But I think everyone's kind of got their own reason to be there, and even though you can't speak to these people for 14 days, you grow a bond and a similarity because you undertake the same journey. So getting there, looking at us all, there'd be nothing in common, but after we had left, we definitely created a similarity or a bond.
In Australia, regulating ayahuasca is a grey area. DMT, the chemical substance within the leaf, is classified as a Schedule 9 substance. Just like marijuana, LSD and ecstasy, it is illegal. But it's also a naturally occurring substance that is found in many forms of organic life, including ourselves. And there just so happens to be very high quantities of DMT in Australian plant species such as acacia. I spoke to Dr. Rod about the presence of ayahuasca in Australia. And you said the drug originated in the South American nations, but how prevalent is the drug in Australia?
Ayahuasca really has gone around the world. It's been in Australia for probably 30 years. The vine itself has been cultivated in Australia for at least that amount of time. I guess two levels of that. There's the plant itself, which can be grown, or the plant substances, which can be grown or sourced within Australia. And then there's the possibility of importing plant substances as well.
Devotees talk about ayahuasca's cathartic and life-changing power. But there is a dark side to the tourism boom as well. With money rolling in and lodges popping up across Peru's sprawling Amazon, a new type of fake shaman has emerged. There have been increased fatalities linked to its ingestion, particularly among tourists.
UK teen found dead in Colombia after participating in tribal drug ritual.
There obviously has been an increase in deaths of tourists in South America on these retreats.
Yeah, I just think overall the numbers of people who are engaging in these activities has really increased dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years. And at the same time, there's no regulation. And there's a lot more people who have less experience in coordinating these retreats. There's perhaps a lot less care involved. I mean, I think at the moment it's just a numbers issue. And there was less coverage of accidents that occurred before, and there was less happened. I just think we're dealing with more people involved now.
Even with the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs issuing travel warnings about Peru and Ecuador's ayahuasca tourism trade, many are still flocking to the Amazon to experience the ritual.
That was Bronte Walker reporting. The future of the plant ayahuasca remains a topic of heated debate. Should it be classified as an illicit substance or a spiritual tool? This is Razor's Edge, the only Sydney-focused current affairs program you'll hear on 2SER. Don't go anywhere, because we speak to the former mayor of Leichhardt, Darcy Byrne, about live music venues in the Inner West. We'll be right back on 2SER.
No matter how big or small the occasion, Crust Pyrmont is your go-to pizza store in the Sydney CBD for office catering. Crust Pyrmont can deliver from 1 to 150 pizzas per order, using the best equipment to make sure your gourmet pizzas are delivered fresh, hot and on time. Choose between ordering online through the Crust Pizza app or simply call the store on 9566 1933.
A proposal to cut red tape and save Sydney's live music and art scene has been put forward to the Inner West City Council. Darcy Byrne, former Mayor of Leichhardt Council and local Labor candidate for Mayor of the Inner West, is one of the people behind the proposal. We spoke to him earlier to explain about the scheme and what it could mean for Sydney's Inner West. Let's talk about the current state of art and culture in Sydney. Why is our local artistic community in such dire straits at the moment?
There's no one reason for the decline of arts and music in the inner city and the inner west of Sydney. But one big problem is that for a long time now, politicians have been conducting themselves like the fun police, seeking to tie up artistic endeavour in red tape and pandering to a tiny minority of complainants who want to see venues shut down. And that is starting to have a really dire impact on our art scene. There's fewer and fewer venues where emerging musicians or visual artists or actors or performers can find space to rehearse, to learn their craft, to perform, to build an audience. And without having those spaces, we will end up with a situation not very far down the track in which there are no longer enough people telling Australian stories through the arts, and that would be a terrible result for us as a nation.
What are some of the challenges our local artists and performers face?
I think Mike Baird and Gladys Berejiklian deserve a lot of the blame for the terrible message they've sent through their attempt to shut down Sydney's nightlife. The message that's gone out to audiences and punters throughout Sydney, New South Wales, Australia and across the world is that Sydney closes down after dark. And word of mouth has had a really detrimental effect. The perception that Sydney is closed, that Sydney is not open, is having a really bad impact on our international reputation. But of course, this problem has been emerging over a much longer period of time. The gentrification of inner city Sydney, the obscene cost of property, has meant that developers are coming in and looking to take up every piece of land that they can and convert it into residential units, which they can get their maximum return from. And that's not leaving any of the sorts of fun, interesting, creative spaces that have traditionally existed here, which were places where gigs and exhibitions could take place. So all of those are contributing factors, but it needs a concerted effort from the public, from music lovers and from politicians of goodwill to try and turn it around.
Absolutely. And so with your proposal for the conversion of properties into small-scale art venues, what do you hope to accomplish with this?
I think there's a lot of spaces across the inner west of Sydney that are being underutilised and which could be used for live performance and for the arts without there being any noticeable impact on residential amenity. There's lots of industrial sites, former factories, office spaces that are used during the day but which lie empty at night, as well as cafes, bookstores, retail premises on main streets where artistic endeavour could take place. You could have young people and not so young people coming in there and performing and or displaying their work, perhaps on an incremental basis, so just for a few days or a few weeks at a time. But it's currently so difficult for the owner of that property to get approval to allow an artistic use. It costs tens of thousands of dollars in many cases. They have to go through a development application process with the council, which is all centred around the idea that the arts is somehow dangerous and needs to be hyper-regulated, which we all know is nonsense, particularly for small-scale arts venues and uses. I want to turn that on its head and send a message and create laws that will allow any property owner outside of a residential zone who would like to have gigs or an exhibition or a theatre performance or a comedy show within their premises, give them a really easy pathway to do that, which can be profitable for them and which can greatly expand the number of spaces that we have available for the arts.
Why has the importance of culture being overlooked by the current political powers, and how do you think that's going to look in moving towards the future?
To be blunt, in my experience previously at Leichhardt Council, there were a number of politicians, often the Greens, to be frank, who found it too tempting to pander to anyone who came forward with a complaint about a venue and didn't realise that in doing that, playing political games, they were putting much love cultural institutions like the Annandale Hotel, for example, into jeopardy. And so that's been part of it, politicians just being opportunistic. But I also think there's just been an undervaluing, a lack of recognition about just how important creative activity is, not just to us as a people and to our, you know, sense of ourselves, but also our economy. I mean, we know, as you were intimating earlier, that successful cities around the world are cities that have very large creative sectors as part of their economy. And there's a huge benefit to Sydney in being a place such as that. So we're in danger of losing that. But if we can get some people in positions of power at the Inner West Council and other councils around Sydney and the New South Wales government all stepping up and saying we are going to be champions for the arts, we can turn it around.
Thanks to Darcy Byrne for taking us through the proposed changes to all that red tape surrounding Sydney's live music venues in the Inner West. You're on Razor's Edge, live on 107.3 and streaming online at 2ser.com. Don't go anywhere. We're talking about the spike in feral cat numbers in Sydney and how intake centres are in dire straits. We'll be back.
Sydney Film Festival is now on sale. There's over 350 screenings of 288 films from 62 countries over 12 days in 10 venues. From the magnificent State Theatre in the city to the Ritz Cinema in Randwick, there's bound to be a film and venue just right for you. It all happens from June 7 to 18, and you can buy your flexi passes or single tickets right now at sff.org.au. Sydney Film Festival, proudly sponsoring 2SER 107.3.
You're back on 2SER, and here on Razor's Edge with me, Jesse Begley. Cat rescue centres across Sydney are making a desperate plea for support in a bid to bounce back from unprecedented season of intakes. Some centres have been forced to completely halt intakes until next season, as demand reaches a peak due to temperature increases. Georgia Clark has this report.
Cats. It's fair to say that you either love them or hate them. Well, love them or hate them, Sydney's stray cats are in dire straits, as foster care centres across Sydney struggle to keep up with the demands of breeding season. One of the charity fosterers, Inner City Strays, in March announced it won't be fostering any more cats for the next few months after a busy summer of intakes. Melly Sauter is the co-founder of Inner City Strays.
This season's been particularly hard. We've had sick kittens come in and we've had a lot of kittens come in, one after the other after the other.
With a city scourged by euthanasia, many believe fostering and adopting stray cats is the only truly humane solution. Christina Vesk is the CEO of the Cat Protection Society.
It's really important that we try our best, but it takes a whole of community effort to be doing what we can to manage that population. So we don't recommend that people just feed street cats. If they want to look after a street cat, then they should have the cat taken to a vet, they should identify them, they should have them de-sexed.
So the bottom line is, if you want to save the lives of these furry critters, don't wait for the pound to pick them up. Consider seeking the advice of your nearest fosterer, and if they're chockers, you may have just found your new furry friend. Sauter says that this proactive approach can save lives.
And that was Georgia Clark ending that report. All right, well, that brings us to the end of this edition of Razor's Edge on 2SER, Sydney's focused current affairs program. Just a thanks to all our producers today, Ellie Madridge, Bronte Walker, Lena Han and Hyo-Jin Shim. If you'd like to hear any story from tonight's program, head to our website at 2ser.com/razorsedge and stay tuned for some fresh music from Static, which is coming up next. I'm Jesse Begley. Enjoy your night, Sydney. This is Sugar from the Pill from our feature album of the week, Slow Dive.
Pages drafted you, and how much have I done so far? I've only done like 1%.
And bang, it was in like a split second. I had no time to react. I was on the ground.
Because the reason why this is even occurring is because there's a demand.